Hi folks, hope all is well. This is Jim Carr saying hello and welcome you to the latest Bantercast, the weekly podcast from the team behind the Banter series of talks and events. At Banter, we put on events in spaces and venues of all shapes and sizes up and down the country. We invite a range of interesting people to come along to tell stories, talk about their lives, or discuss various topics and themes. We record what happens in the room and then we podcast the results. Over the summer, we've been doing a monthly residency at the Bullet Hotel in Belfast, and it produced this fascinating discussion on the future of work. We were joined on the night by Adrian Hanna from Right Revenue, Kevin Curran, Professor of Cybersecurity at the University of Ulster, and Philip Brady from Citibank to talk about how groundbreaking developments in technology and artificial intelligence will mean many changes to workplaces in the years and decades to come. Are any of our jobs safe from robots? Indeed, will Banter in 2027 just feature a bunch of robots having their chats about pesky humans? The sound quality on this podcast, which you're about to hear, may well have been better had it been a robot rather than me in charge of things, so apologies for this. Hi folks, how y'all doing? Hope you're all well. Welcome along to the future of work, Banter on the future of work. The robots are coming up the stairs. If anyone just say, the robots are on the way up the stairs. We'll be here in about 15 minutes. I guarantee you they're going to walk in. So, first of all, a few words about Banter. Banter is a series about public talks, interviews and discussions. And we started doing this series in Belfast last month, was one on Belfast music scene. We've got one next month on basically gay life in Northern Ireland as part of the Belfast Pride Festival, but it's nice to future work, and it's great to see such interest in the topic as well. So we've got three great panels, and I'm going to ask each one of them to basically just say a few words about who they are and introduce themselves to you. Starting at the very end, we have Philip Brady. Philip is a late addition, he's a super sub. Phil, tell us about yourself.
Sure, so I just came off the bench yesterday, and so I work in Citibank, and I work in leadership development under learning umbrella. And I coach and facilitate leadership programs and look after them as well to make sure that we tap into the potential. But what we're really interested in is the kind of behaviors and skills that these leaders need to embody and also cascade down to their teams and directs and make sure that they're forward compatible and have the skills that we need in the future. So that's a little bit about me.
Okay, thank you very much. Adrian?
I'm Adrian Hanna, and I am the founder of a company called Right Revenue. And we are very privileged to work in hotels like this. We work in hospitality, and it is our job to write software to make predictions on when hotels are going to be busy, when they're going to be quiet, and to predict pricing and business trends, so when they're going to be busy with corporates or leisure people or weddings or whatever, and set pricing to help make them more profitable. So we have introduced artificial intelligence and machine learning into our system. And I guess that's why I'm here. Please don't ask me any difficult questions, because I really have no idea. But yeah, that's a little bit about us.
All right, thank you very much, Adrian. Kevin?
So I'm Kevin Curran. I'm a professor of cybersecurity at Ulster University. So I'm based on McGee campus. I started lecturing there about 18 years ago. So my background is in computer networks, and I used to be a software developer. But in recent years, most of my research has been in security, which is good for me. That's a career that will never die. But I also, obviously, I supervise PhD students who work in determining where people move indoors, but increasingly on security projects as well.
Excellent, so that's great. It's really interesting, because when we kind of put this topic out there, there was a kind of a feedback of kind of like reasons to be cheerful and reasons to be fearful. And it's almost like, you know, the future of work, what exactly will it be? Is the idea of kind of like a job for life completely dead? Is the idea of like being the fact that the job you're in right now, will you still be in this job 5 years from now or even at the end of your career? And it's interesting to kind of look at I suppose, the biggest move that every single person here in this room, their lifetime's experience, has been the internet. Whether you're a digital native or whether you're someone who saw the internet coming up while you were working, it's incredible what's happened. It's the great figure from France. In France, the internet destroyed 500,000 jobs, completely took away 500,000 jobs, but it created 1.2 million jobs. So that was a net increase of 700,000 jobs that the internet created. So when we talk about automation and we talk about the robots and we talk about all these new things coming down the line, it's an opportunity, right? Would you agree with that? Or am I kind of like doing a typical journalist thing of getting a figure from somewhere and just kind of extrapolating an idea from it?
Well, I certainly think for us, it's an opportunity to create jobs. Like, we are a startup. We've only been in business a couple of years. There's now six of us on the team. If any of you are developers, by the way, I have jobs for you all, just please. And literally, we can't employ enough people to build the tech quick enough. And, you know, we are looking for data scientists, we're looking at developers. So, you know, we're hopefully going to be creating jobs, but the gap that we're actually filling in the hospitality industry, I would say through time may replace certain skills, but actually will improve the skills of the existing people in some of the hotels. So, you know, I don't know if it'll actually take away anything in our industry. I think it'll only add to it.
Right, okay. What about you, Philip? Can you see basically, like, I mean, this new wave of automation, this new wave where we're going to being the same boon and same bust in many ways as the internet was?
It could be for some, but I think you have to set yourself up to be clever about it. So I'm inherently lazy. I don't like doing things that don't add value to my day. So I always try and optimize by asking the question: is this going to add value or take away? And I think Sky had an interesting question, which was: is it going to make the bike faster? And if it doesn't make the bike faster, well, then you don't do it. So for me, not being lazy and not interested in detail and admin, I don't want to do them tasks, so I can automate it. So I'm quite interested in that, because what I'm interested in is being a human and being good at being a human. So I like thinking about stuff, coming up in complex kind of problem solving, drawing pictures, and I can show you some of my pictures from, this is how I think about stuff that we're trying to fix in our leadership programs. A robot can't do that the way I do it, and I think that relationship building and that kind of thing, I'm really hopeful about, because I think a robot can't make friends. I'm really good at that, and if any of you want to be my friend, I'd be really good. If you can pitch for staff, I can pitch for friends. But I think that that's the value that we add, and myself and my girlfriend and Gleb were talking before we come up here, and I said something, and I wrote it down because I thought it was really interesting, and it's a day isn't a day unless you feel like a human. And that was about making a mistake and failure. And a robot isn't going to be that conscious to think about that. And I thought that that was quite interesting to share. And I think that that's the value that we add.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
You can't replace that.
Okay, that's it. That's the empathy. Kevin?
Sorry, when you mentioned data scientists again, sorry. You might have seen data scientists coming out of Stanford right now. New graduates are being offered jobs at $250,000. They're just, these are the... people,
yeah,
really,
I know.
Because it's,
I know, I feel the pain.
Proper data scientist, which requires a background in stats, really, and computational intelligence techniques. Being able to program and just being able to have a mathematical mind slant as well. It's just, but sorry, just to go off topic slightly again about optimization your job. There's a good article in one of the news aggregators I read about this guy who hired someone to come in and see. Is he doing his work well? So the guy came in, I don't know what the term for the person is, some consultant of some sort. And he came in, he sat in the corner on day one, didn't say anything, and then he left, and then he came in the next day, and the guy was expecting him to tell him what about it. He just sat in the corner, he did that for 5 days, and at the end of the 5 days, he gets up and he says, the guy kind of says, you know, well, help me, you know. And so he asked the boss who he was looking at, he said, what are your three... what are your three missions in your organization? And he named the three of them off, and he says, you haven't spent any time in either and any of them. Yes, you were busy, you were constantly as busy as I've seen, but everything was a distraction of getting you against your mission. But the conclusion of the article was really setting aside slots in your day for thinking, strategic thinking about your future and what it, and also, but we all just chase our emails. I mean, I'm constantly chasing the zero inbox. Whether or not we think technology will jobs disappear, we just know we have to be involved in technology. We know that everything's moving to technology. The more of a fear you are with it, you know, when college kids come in nowadays, they have to be able to go to social media, they have to be able to use Blackboard, they have to be able to log on, send emails, create PDFs, merge PDFs, spit PDFs. You know, you can imagine the computer science department, we require a lot more tools even, but you can imagine a student coming in now who's never really looked at a computer. You know, it would be just so far behind.
Yeah.
In other words, but we have to embrace it. We have to deal with
it.
I've said for years, many times, as an ex-musician, don't send your kids to piano lessons anymore. You know, send them to computer classes, because that's the thing of the past. No one goes to a party now and plays a piano. They just plug in their iPod or iP- call it. No, they don't even plug it in, they just link it to the nearest Bluetooth speaker.
Yeah.
So things move, you know, to have any success in modern life, you know, you just got to embrace technology and get
yeah.
in there. And,
I mean, the good news is, like, I mean, there are reasons to be optimistic. MGI Research did a poll in 46 countries and looked at 2,000 work activities, and they found that the proportion of occupations that can be fully automated at the moment using technology or robots is less than 5%. Right, so we're way ahead of the curve here, you know. I mean, the other finding is, I think, is like that 60% of all occupations have at least 30% of activities that are technically automatable based on currently demonstrated and working technologies. It'll be two decades from now, 20 years, before automation reaches 50%. So we're way ahead of the curve. I mean, the discussion here about the future of work, we look at something that's maybe 15, 20 years down the road. So that's the reason to be optimistic, right? Or is it?
It's possible that we can underestimate the dramatic moves in technology. Like, the iPhone's only 10 years old, YouTube's only 10 years old. You know, there could be an exponential growth with technology. Again, funny enough, that some of the jobs they say are the safest are, you know, with a 0.81% chance of having no automation is being a priest. Yeah, so generally it comes down to whether your job is creative, whether creativity is needed. So that's kind of secure, but that's going to hold out the longest. Whether or not there's complexity involved in it. You know, so plumbers and things where you can't really create a robot who does everything, goes through a job and a call-out, emergency. So those type of jobs are more secure in the long run. But again, it's ones which can be automated, again, like call centres or whatever else. You know, believe it or not, that they're actually near the start of being automated.
Yeah.
So again, it goes through your categorization, but even law firms will see a dramatic shift in what can be done, and they'll have to move into different areas, really.
Yeah, I was telling Philip a story this morning. We were on the phone about a friend of mine. She's kind of like, I don't know, has anyone seen the film Reservoir Dogs? You know, yeah, Harry Keitel's character, Mr. Wolf, in that, or maybe it's Pulp Fiction. He goes around cleaning up messes. Her job is cleaning up corporate messes, right? She's a hard ass. And I always kind of thought, she's never going to be replaced. And last time I met her, she was kind of saying, in 5 years, she reckons her job will be kind of completely automated. So she's kind of going like, okay, what do I find next? And she made the point, and you kind of made the point as well, Warren Philip, that, and you've just made it again, Kevin. It's like, one of the areas that, like, is future-proof in some ways, is creativity, is it being an artist. But, like, you know, is that going to be hacked as well, do you think?
Music is already hacked, so you can already use... I think it's Watson is IBM.
It is.
Yeah.
And Watson can use so many different... You can point it in different directions. So music is one, and it's already created a soundtrack to a film. And the way that they did it was they found the most emotional piece in the music and just put it together in a really clever way. And, like, we were at a talk recently in a Turing lecture in one of the places in Belfast, and they talked that we don't compete with technology, we partner with it, and it's how you can use it in a clever way. But the reason I was saying earlier on about the creative piece is because I play music, so I think that I'm quite feeling competitive about it. But I play music live, and I think that a robot can't do that either. So a robot can't pick up my guitar and play it. But the other thing to come back to as well around the time scale. So if we have 15 to 20 years before it's 50% adoption rate of technology taking our jobs, that means that I and all of us have 15 to 20 years to prep for it and learn the skills and get better at what we need to get better at, rather than reacting in 20 years and go, oh, I can't believe that happened.
Yeah.
I think that's really optimistic.
Yeah.
Yeah, but how do you reskill a lot of people that are maybe, like, Nick tells the story, and I work together, Nick tells the story of, you know, sort of supermarkets and, like, no cashiers and no staff, that you go in and everything's scanned and it knows what you've bought, and you walk in and you walk out, and that, you know, Amazon is so automated. And what about the people on the minimum wage that are shopkeepers or, you know, working in retail or working in those levels? How do we future... it terrifies me, actually. How do you actually future-proof yourself for those skills? It's okay saying, you know, data scientists and insurance and finance is going to be automated, but what about everyone else doing the normal jobs that are going to be
taken? That's a really good point, because they've been completely overlooked in many ways. You know, this move to automation is going to create a class of, like, where we've got more time on our hands than we actually got work. And the people you're describing there, Adrian, it brings to mind what happened down in Limerick when the Dell factory closed. Dell employed 3,500 people in Limerick. There were assembly line jobs, and these are, like, I'm from Tipperary, so an awful lot of people in my neighbourhood were kind of like working in Dell, you know, and it was grand. It was a well-paying job, and it supplemented their farming. So when Dell closed down, they moved off to Poland because it's cheaper to move to Poland. IDA Ireland, Enterprise Ireland, send down all these dudes to kind of like retrain these farmers, these farm labourers, these kind of like, I mean, this labouring class as entrepreneurs to start up their own business. These lads didn't want to start up their own business. They had no interest in starting up their business. And it's like as you said, there was no option for them, you know. And I'm kind of wondering, is that something that like, is that come down? Do you think it's come down to a personal choice that you've kind of got to skill yourself up, or is it something that government and something that education facilities should be working towards?
Well, I think there's people that, no matter what, there are people that are happy doing what they're doing. Like you said, they're farmers. They're working a factory. They work in a shop, and they don't want the stress and the hassle that the rest of us go through day to day. So it's okay saying, oh, you have to reskill, and you have to learn all this new stuff. But you know what if that you don't want anything else other than that. I don't know. I don't know that there is an answer to it.
To some degree, governments are like in education and universities to STEM. Governments give a lot of money for science, technology, engineering, and maths. We're seeing departments closing down, and you have to make kind of nearly as a university, you nearly have to make an economic case to keep your English department open, your history department. One's word is no real. You have to argue for the economic impact upon society, and a lot of universities are closing down all these departments and opening up more to do with science departments. Again, so to some degree, governments are trying to do that. Again, go back to, like I said, that the jobs which are safest are the ones of creativity, the ones with any unpredictability, and the other ones are anywhere emotional intelligence is required, like nursing, social care, being a doctor even, actually, for a long time, that'll be safe. Even though,
But all those kind of like mean jobs you just described there, maybe not social care, but like all they require a level of a level of education, a level of expertise, a level of understanding, which at the agents, for the jobs the agents just been describing about that are going to be automated, that won't exist. It's not possible to square that circle.
Can be hard to see where it changes, because I know the high streets of this world will never be as full as they are now. So go through any town at the moment, no matter where it is, you will just see a gradual, and not even gradual, you will see a marked decrease of shop front after shop front closing down because they can't compete with the prices. My postman came today and he had 12 parcels from Amazon. So you want to see the future for the public, you just look at the geeks, the early adopters. You know, I'm a technology family, but everything I do gets repeated by my mother somewhere in London and my neighbours later and later. You know, we're just at the forefront. Everything we buy it out, apart from the perishables, or is from light bulbs, everything else, you know. And he's just coming. So I would have thought, okay, well, post office, we're going through a struggle a few years ago because, and they're still closing their branches, but the rise of online shopping has actually meant a lot of these are actually, they're actually hiring drivers because of the delivery services.
Yeah.
And it is sad.
You know, what happens when the drones come in and deliver for
And that will actually happen.
Yeah.
But it might be a little bit, but they just work. They're like the DJI drones you're getting, because some of the drones for 250 quid now that have a 2 mile range and can land on a pin. You know, that was the dreams of science fiction a few years ago.
Mm. So when it comes to this let's call it a kind of like, I mean, a class, a suite of people, Phil, that agents just been describing here, that class of people that their jobs are going to be completely automated in the future. Like, can you see what's going to happen there? I mean, are we creating kind of like, it's technology. Technology always causes disruption. The internet created disruption. The car created disruption. But like this kind of disruption, where suddenly all these jobs, all these kind of manual jobs are gone. I know it's kind of like it's not your area, but like at the same time, given what you're seeing about leadership and what you're seeing about like career development inside Citibank, what do you see happening to these people?
It's really change or be changed. Change is the only constant, so it's going to happen. And if you choose to embrace technology, whatever that is, or you choose not to, that's still a choice, and you still have a point of decision there. So it's change or be changed. Technology is not going to slow down because I have a problem with it.
Mm.
So I think change will be changed. Pivot and learn. And if the skills that you have to learn are different to what you currently possess, we've 15 to 20 years before we need to know them. So you've loads of time to practice and get good at it. And I think that's more interesting to focus on rather than I can't believe that it's done this and complain about it. If you complain about it, it's because you can see something better. And better could be, you're not competing. Let's find a way to partner instead.
Yeah.
Okay, and maybe it could be a case of, like, you know, people who are currently employed fixing cars or, like, you know, working on those jobs suddenly have jobs kind of fixing drones. You know, I mean, like, you know, it could be a situation that, like, the jobs of the future don't exist right now, but there will be a need for kind of like certain skill sets that currently exist.
So you say about mechanics. So it's really interesting about BMW mechanics, because I was thinking about applying when I heard the money that they're paid. And the difference is that instead of fixing sockets and joints, they're fixing computers. So their salary went from, let's say, 20 grand a year to £80,000 just for a BMW mechanic. I think that's exciting. I would focus on the 60 grand rather than the 20 that I was on.
Yeah. I also kind of think as well that, like in, you know, I mean, there's a lot of research based around what you've talked about, Adrian. There's also a lot of research based around like basic income. I mean, the idea of kind of bringing in a basic income as a way of kind of getting around this. But like, I think what we also kind of forget is that like automation has already kind of like created these kind of changes. There was a dude who tweeted me when we were talking to this guy called Jeff Meredith, and he was saying that back in 2001, his job in the Met office went because it was automated. But like, he's still going, you know what I mean? He's still doing something else now. So again, it's like, I mean, it's a case of like, as you just kind of say, it's either you have to adopt.
I think it's going to be hard though for a certain sector of people and jobs to adapt. You know whether it's politically correct to say it or not, there are people who potentially don't go through education, that don't go to further education, don't have those skills. Whether they choose that road or not, they may not have those skills. And we can't all say that everyone is going to be skilled up to be, you know, fantastic at this, fantastic at that. So I think you're right that we all have to be aware that, you know, there is change and it's coming and all of those wonderful things. But I think that there's still going to be massive disruption in what we're seeing now as maybe minimum wage people or people who just, for whatever reason, don't have the skill set to maybe go on and do all these other things. So I don't think we should all say that we can all retrain everybody and everybody's going, it's all going to be wonderful. I think definitely there's going to be disruption at a level of society, without a doubt.
Right. There's always a correlation between education and society and GDP and chaos literally.
Yeah.
Just a few years ago, the health minister in South Africa did not believe that AIDS was caused by a virus. The guy only had a second grade education. I mean, you know, what do you do there, you know?
Yeah.
Do you think that country's going to lead the world? But again, you talk about the basic income. There was a great article a few weeks ago in the New York Times talking about that. Basically, that because of the income and automation and the belief by the author of this report, believed that jobs would not be compensated, that the government would have to bring in a basic income for the population and tax the giants of the world. But of course, that might work in the United States and in China, where the leading companies are, you know, and it's kind of a winner gets all as well, because the key thing, you keep hearing the term, you know, artificial intelligence. When it comes to computer people, when you talk to computer scientists, we never really mention artificial intelligence. We talk about machine learning, because that's a practical, you know, demonstrable aspect of it, and it really is all machine learning, all the clever things you see. And machine learning always comes down to just one thing, because it's not magical. There is that black box where it does make decisions which you can't retrace, but it's just pattern matching. If you take any machine learning algorithm, how it works and how it looks for patterns, even go back to DeepMind, who bet the couple, it's always a pattern. And again, the victory, and the reason we've arrived at this state, in the recent few years, we've seen great breakthroughs with convolutional neural networks, so is because finally we got GPUs and computers in the cloud, and also the rise of data. So we have large amounts of data, because the more data you have, the better your algorithms will work. And then we have the GPUs to go with that, and they become done quite cheaply as well. But so again, the better your data, the more data you have, the better your algorithms will be, the better your products will be. The better your products will be, the more people will buy your products, the more data you have. And it's this virtuous circle. And that's why the giants, Google, will only get better and bigger and stronger, and the ones, you know, Facebook as well, of machine learning, but also the ones in China, and then the Ubers of this world, the ones who are using the data for the road and the cloud. So you will only find that the giants will kind of capture all that. So that would work maybe in the States if you brought in something. But how do you tax a country which doesn't have any of these technological giants really in the world that are robust? So because the money will go back to these giants.
Yeah.
It's in the
interest of those giants to actually fund the basic income, because basically if people have income, they can buy those services, buy those goods. So it's in their interest, you know? I want to kind of go back to something, like, we're going to go back to this in a second, but I want to kind of come back to something else, and it's a mindset change. Like, how many people in this room worked a 9-to-5 job or thereabouts today? Vast majority of people. If you're in a certain time, leave a certain time. I park my car in the car park about 5 o'clock. 5 past 5, because like I got caught last time. I pulled into the car park at 5:01, thinking like I was going to be £5 the evening, and then I realised at the end of the day when I was leaving, it was £22. Anyway, that's another story completely. I needed a robot to tell me it wasn't on time. But I remember I was just walking around for about half an hour, and it's like, I remember being up in Belfast 20 years ago and just walking around as well, and it's the same pattern of people. They're leaving work at the same time. It's like, you know, people have this idea about a job, and all of you have kind of talked about jobs, and people have it. People define themselves by a job. They define themselves by the job title, the hours they work. And many people, they might have a hobby as well, but for most people, it's one job. That mindset also has to change. And like I'm very aware of that kind of fact at the moment. I had a conversation with someone yesterday who works as a journalist in Dublin as well. But besides working as a journalist, she also has two or three other what she calls kind of like lily pads. That, like, you know, that if will happen with newspaper journalism, it will die down. She can kind of jump on. She's a club promoter. She's a broadcaster. She's working all over the place. Is this also something we're kind of going to see, the rise of kind of like gigonomics, the rise of that gig economy? We've already seen it with kind of Uber. But is this something that, like, I mean, those people in Belfast who are working that 9-to-5 job are suddenly going to realize, hang on a second, I've got to rethink what my whole working life's about. Phil?
Absolutely. I've tried to get that kind of funded in City recently, and literally my slide said gig economy, City gig, and how do we get that started? Because I think even internally in a company you can do the same thing. So if I have 10 skills and I work on one project, I can split my time 10 ways and work on it whenever I want and pick and choose the work and then apply my skills to whatever way I want to do that. And it's really interesting when you think about it. Like, it's the freelancer economy, and Elance, a huge company that probably first started in that kind of space, are already in that kind of mindset of, if you're not in that space and have the skill, they've now gone to the education piece and want to upskill people to be able to do it. So I think, again, you have a choice, adapt or die. So adapt will upskill you to learn to be better able to do the thing. It's just a matter of resources. Do you have the resources available to upskill you to be able to do it? And once you've internet access, you've access to everything.
But then there's certain, like, you know, that's great, and that's a great new gold dream. But, like, I mean, there's certain drawbacks there, because, I mean, you mentioned kind of like, you know, you're competing against everyone else. They're competing on price as well. So, like, you know, if you're on kind of freelancer.com, you're up against people from India that kind of come down on price. But, like, that idea of that kind of gig economy, Adrian, from your point of view, where you stand, does that terrify you? Does that kind of, like, scare you in many ways? Or do you kind of, like, see that's going to be the way that you in 10 years' time is going to be? You're going to have, like, three different kind of, like, strings to your bow.
I have this kind of good person that sits on this shoulder and this bad person that sits on this shoulder. And I suppose I am of a certain age and was brought up in a very regimented 9-to-5, and working like that. And you had a certain skill and you did it and that was it. Certainly starting this new business and working with software developers and people who are very, this whole new breed, like Nick is a geek on the scale, but my God, the other people we're talking to are like way, like he's Captain Sensible compared to some of them, and they definitely do want a very different way of working. For us as a small business, that's actually quite hard to manage at the minute, because we have literally all hands on deck and we need people around and doing things. But certainly as our business grows, we will have to be more flexible, and that's something that I definitely am happy to embrace. But our business in 2 years has changed completely. Machine learning has brought in a whole new level into our business that I didn't even know existed 2 years ago, and the skill set that we're now looking at will do different things and work in different ways and potentially work in different countries and will work in different time zones, and that is something that we as a small business will have to manage and have to embrace. I have to be honest and say it's not easy. It's really not easy in a small business environment to have that. But it's certainly, as we potentially grow our business, it's something that we will have to be very aware of, that people need flexibility and will have different skill sets and dip in and dip out of things. Sure.
When you started seeing that idea within Citibank, Philip, about the gig economy, what was the reaction of people inside?
It's not how we work at the moment. So it's like everything. Change, you have to, it's uncomfortable. Nobody likes it. But you support moving out of your comfort zone with resources or support or coaching or mentoring or managing, and you can push through that kind of change in mindset and encourage people and show them that actually it's not that bad.
Yeah.
There's the benefits to you. Try it in this really safe to fail environment and experiment.
Yeah.
And then let's see. Let's have a different conversation at the end.
Right. Does it? There's something that kind of like Kevin said earlier on that kind of struck me. You were talking about like me, people walking out of Stanford and it's $250,000 a year in salaries as data scientists. You know, does the fact that many people in Citibank are probably on really good wages mean that they feel in some way insulated from these things you're talking about?
That's a really good question. Not necessarily, because the way that we try to communicate at certain levels, we're telling people that this is the future, give them the information that they need, involve them in certain initiatives that get them kind of curious about things. Like we do a lot of like hackathons, a kind of technology, kind of play with technology, get used to it, explore it. And we do a 30-day development challenge, which is focused on certain kind of future behaviors that we're trying to encourage people to try and then adopt. So let's say being bold, being agile, being curious, and then being innovative and actually just safe to fail, experiment with things and challenge your work or challenge assumptions and your thinking. So we're doing it at every level of the organization. So that's open to all learners, but we have a number of leaders who pitch in and add to the conversation and their thoughts and how they're reacting and responding to it as well.
Yeah.
And it's really interesting seeing the disparity, but also the fact that it's quite leveled because we can all comment to whoever the CEO is and say, I think this is my experience of this challenge. How has it been for you? And we have some interesting conversations. And I think that's what changes things, is having conversations about it rather than fearing it and locking yourself in a cupboard.
Right. From your point of view, Kevin, like when you interact with students, because you're interacting with people before they win the workforce, you know, what are their expectations of what happens when they leave University of Ulster? Like, are they all thinking about jobs? Are they thinking about this gig economy? Does the idea of kind of like having to work maybe one day a week as an Uber driver, another day a week as a Deliveroo driver, another day a week as a kind of like, as a robot washing dryer, does that kind of like frighten them? What's their expectations?
No, their expectation is that they'll all get jobs because computer science. Yeah, it's funny, but I'm a believer in narrow, is it? Like it's narrowing down, actually, in what you do as early as possible. My son left school at 12, but he's been doing it. He knows what he wants to do since he was, you know, computer science.
He left school when he was 12?
Yeah, he left school when he was 12, yeah. He's been doing an open university degree since he was 12, yeah. So he's nearly finished. It's funny. But I'm a believer in that as well, specialising.
Yeah.
It's funny, you know, of course I had a general education, then I went on to college and everything else, but I don't believe that, and he would totally agree, you know, like, he'll have huge gaps in his conversations when he meets people later in life, you know, like, things that we take for granted, like World War II, World War I, roughly when it was, and you might not need to know who the general was on each side at a certain time, but he'll have huge gaps like that, but he'll just get over that. He just knows what he wants to do. So I'm a believer in focusing early.
Yeah.
That you can go to school quite a lot and just be learning with stuff that's not really, you know, just wasting your time. But if you put the hours in into your chosen field, I'm letting my younger son have a more general education, but I think maybe next year he'll want to specialise. I'm just a believer in finding, if you're fortunate enough, I know there's people, I was fortunate when I was younger, I knew what I wanted to do when I first seen a computer. But I'd been in college and I'd been in class with people who were brighter than me, but just happened to choose computers maybe because their dad said it. You know, and then they went on their great careers or whatever, you know. I've always been fortunate in that. So I do know that some people don't know early on, so therefore what can they do? You know, so really they've got to go through the general education thing really until they find out what their strengths are. But I think when you look at what you are, I think early on you can see what your strengths are. And quite often it runs in a family. But again, it's probably not that simple. I just believe in definitely deep.
Good. That's a topic for another banter. I mean, I tried, like, you know, that definitely is. But I want to kind of circle back to something you said when you were talking about at the very start, Adrian. You said something that said, "Geez, that's really interesting." I want to go back to your talk, but you talk about, like, I mean, that in your business it's about, like, I mean, like, tweaking that algorithm to find out, like, I mean, about demand, pricing on hotel rooms kind of like on demand. You know, is that something that in years gone by would have been done manually, or is that a completely new sort of, like, I mean, like, value assumption that's only come in because of the kind of machine learning you're using?
Well, I'm going to bore you now for a couple of minutes.
This is
my pitch I've been doing it for years. So Right Revenue actually was never supposed to be a business. I've been doing a manual revenue manager's job for about 14 years now, freelance, and I'm so lucky to work in lots of fantastic hotels. So what I was doing was going in, and I went back and did my distance learning with Cornell University on how to be a proper revenue manager, because it's all math and all algorithms and predictions. So like, if you fly to London, you know the person in the seat beside you is going to have paid a different price. You expect that, but very few people expect that within a hotel room. Like, every hotel room tonight here will have been sold at a different price. So I was going in and doing that in hotels, trying to do this predictive stuff sort of a year and a half out. And thank goodness, through luck or whatever, I actually got quite good at it and really enjoyed it. And I was giving hotels spreadsheets to track things on, and had all the mathematical formula all linked into these spreadsheets. But every time I went back to the hotel, the buggers had taken the formula out and nothing was making any sense. So I went to a few of them and went, well, what if I put this in the cloud? What if I put it on the internet and you couldn't take the formula out, and then I can see it and you can see it and it'll all be great? And they said yes. And suddenly I was then developing software and remortgaging my house and not eating for 3 years. And
startup bootcamp.
Oh my God, yes, horrendous. So we started a business. We got investment. I was lucky enough that Nick came on board. We now have a team, and we've got some really clever people in the business, and it's great. Still hemorrhaging cash, and we still need developers, just in case you'd forgotten. But when Nick and I started working together, we literally had taken that mathematical formula from those spreadsheets and was applying this and thinking, this is great, this is wonderful, we're doing all this pricing. And then we employed this other guy who went, nah, that's a bit shite. I can do it much better than that. Let's put some machine learning in. And he ran, so he's taking the hotel data, he's taking the mathematical algorithms, he's taking my kind of 20 years of knowledge, and then he's going, okay, exactly what you said, let's look at patterns. Let's start to build this and that and whatever. And we started to run this AI in the background for about 6 months, and suddenly he was getting more accurate than I was. Which is great. So now we've got this really clever product that we're rolling out to hotels. That's, you know, helping them set prices and becoming more profitable. Because believe it or not, I'm going to do a pitch for the hotel industry here. The average, if you buy a hotel room at £100, the average profit, net profit that a hotel makes is £6 per room. On £100 rate. Mm. So there's not a, that's why if we're not about pushing the pricing up, we're about trying to work out, when can you push it a little bit more? When do you need to sell cheap? When do you need to put special offers and things in the market? So that's what we're trying to do, is to try and make these hotels a little bit more profitable. But yeah, the AI has just... I've even forgotten your question. I've been rambling.
You've answered the question, because what you basically said, Adrian, is that, like you know, it was manual, but, like, I mean, yes. when you moved it to kind of like machine learning and you, like, brought AI in, that you were able to kind of scale it up.
Absolutely. Scale it up, and suddenly the... When you put it in front of hotels now, and they use it for a while and they see the accuracy, and that doesn't matter. Like, the first hotel we rolled it out to was the Fleet Hotel in Dublin, which a really, we put it in possibly the most aggressive market that we could in Ireland to see where it broke, and it hasn't broken, and they love it, and it's great. So now we've got this product that we can roll out. But yeah, it is a lot more clever, and it's only something that is going to get clever and clever as we, because at the minute... when we had started to roll this out with my Excel spreadsheets, we had about 12 or 15 metrics coming in to make a decision on pricing. At the minute, Nick, correct me if I'm about 40-something, 40, 45 little pieces of trending that we're looking at. But by the time we roll it out, there'll be close to 1,000 metrics in to make it really clever. So yeah, the machine learning has completely changed our business, completely changed the business model.
And what's fascinating from like your 3 minutes, you're thinking you're doing a pitch on what, on your businesses, but what you're also kind of like, you're also kind of like extrapolating and explaining there as well as that how you adapt to these changes. You know, the future of work for you and the future of work for your company was basically like taking something that you had as a manual, applying everything that's out there to it, and the next thing you've got a business that's kind of scaling it. And again, I mean, I'm an optimist by nature anyway. Like, I'm quite optimistic about the future of work in many ways. And like, you know, you talked earlier on about, like, I mean, I suppose the kind of like the people who won't have enough work in the future, people who are currently working, the jobs will be automated. But like, you know, I'm kind of, again, it's going back to what kind of Philip said earlier on, the opportunities are there. And is the case, this is just a general question now for all three of you, is the case that maybe that, like, you know, that this idea about the future work is kind of, it has scared people too much, that we need to kind of, like, I mean, in many ways kind of like change the question in some ways and realize that, like, the future work's already here, and it's a case of adopting. What do you reckon?
Yeah, I suppose I just believe education is a key that I
okay, let's take this education thing then. Okay, so you talked earlier on about the fact that moving away from kind of like being English history and kind of like whatever else it was back to STEM, right? Is that one way going? I'm kind of wondering about like starting your own business, entrepreneurial kind of spirit. Can that be taught, or is that something that we're all kind of, you're either born with or you're not born with?
I would love to see that in schools. I would love for business owners to be taken into schools and told to tell students about, first of all, how hard it is and the hard work you have to put in, but how exciting and wonderful it is, because you know, I think school puts you through this funnel, which for a lot of kids is great and wonderful, but it doesn't always prepare you for life outside and life in industry. It doesn't, and I think there's a whole area there that we are failing to address. And from my point of view, getting kids into STEM, especially girls, like, there's no reason why girls can't be data scientists, computer scientists, but they're not choosing that career for, and I actually don't know the answer to that. I don't know the reason.
Generally, it's not enough female role.
I mean, because, like, you know, everyone knows the problem exists, but like, people can't come up with solutions. I work with Intel on doing stuff. This is something that they come up again and again, the lack of kind of like females getting involved in STEM, and all the kind of opportunities are there, all the initiatives are there, but nothing ever happens, you know?
Yeah.
Going back to Citibank thing, your own personal take on that kind of film. You know, when you went to school, was kind of entrepreneurship, was it taught? Was it mentioned?
In school, no. In university, it was a piece of my degree, and I deliberately chose that, and I actually set up a company to try and pay for college. So I set up a dance company just to try it, and I wrote a blog about it today on one of our kind of internal collaborative tools. And I did it for three reasons. One was to make money, one was to try and run a business, and one was to meet girls.
Did you succeed?
Sorry, Katie, my girlfriend. But I succeeded for a while. I failed after a couple of weeks, but it was worth the experience because I learned and grew. I think when you learn how to learn, and when you have access to the resources like the internet that we now have, we should teach kids them kind of things, because then you level the playing field. I follow a lot of Tim Ferriss, and that's kind of back to the optimizing piece. And what he talks about is he took out a loan for 100 grand and didn't do an MBA. He instead tried to set up a company and pitch it to venture capitalists. And that was his education, was actually practical. Let's try it. Let's experiment. I have this money. I'm going to blow it anyway. It's going to be out of date by the time I qualify. And I mean this in a respectful way to university degrees, but it doesn't equip you for when you get out day one, 100 grand in debt, and then what?
Yeah.
I'm not able for the world. I don't know how to learn anything because I'm not used to discomfort.
That again comes back then to personal responsibility. You know, there's a friend of mine who runs a college in the UK, and he's a principal of a college in the UK. And it's like, you know, he said what you've just said. He would say the same thing. He's sending students out into the world loaded with debt, and it's like, you know, they're not ready. And it comes down then to kind of like, I mean, to my mind, you know, when it comes to future work, there's three angles to consider. There's a personal angle, there's the organisational angle, and there's a societal angle. So let's kind of, I suppose, to wrap up before we get some questions from the audience. Let's go through them kind of one. One's a personal angle, you know, like the adjustments we all have to make. If talk a little bit about that, like who wants to start with that, but what kind of adjustments have you yourself made in terms of how you work that you reckon people should also consider in terms of future work as well?
I can talk forever about the personal part because I adore that area. So for me, so I'm new in a role. I only joined in November. I've had to learn an awful lot, but the people, the way that I've learned the most has been from people. I've spoken to people that know a lot more than I will ever know, and adapted to that difference, which was just down on my laptop and get it done in the end of the day and chuck out something, which is usually in tech. And I think that the behaviours that I had to adopt to, I recognised that I needed to change. And it's interesting to explore not being good at something, learning it from the ground up, and being okay with discomfort. And that's why I come back to that. Like, we're in a Netflix society where you're, if I want season 2 of Lord of the Rings, I can get it by just clicking a button. We're not used to actually working for something and doing the 10,000 hours it takes to get mastery at something. Mm-hmm. So I think when we get used to being uncomfortable, trying in a safe to fail environment, well, then we can try all this stuff, experience it, and then get great at it.
Yeah,
and build that confidence in yourself that I can actually try anything.
Mm. In many ways, Kevin, you already addressed the personal by talking about your son.
Yeah, but I suppose that wasn't personal. but yeah, it's just putting the hours in, really. Just working as hard. Yeah, I mean, just being focused as well. Keeping the goal in mind, because you can become distracted with just replying to emails and taking on things and going to events and pleasing people. But see, all of you have different indicators of excellence which you need for your promotion, as you know. Everyone's job here is different to get to the next level, but when it comes to university, it's generally funding. How much funding can you bring in? And then just below that is how many research papers have you written, but of the research papers you published, how many citations do they get? And then of course you go down, you know, how many PhD students have you supervised to completion, everything else. But there's only one thing that really, you know, and even for your interview at university, you never get asked about teaching. It's just presumed you can teach a class. All they care about is your funding, your CV, your, you know, up to there. It's all to do with everything but teaching. Hence why, you know, we've so many people who are terrible English, actually, from over. Just great researchers, but the English is not their native language, and sometimes the students can be impacted, but that's the same the world over. But a few years ago, I really had to refocus on the funding, because you changed the criteria for promotion. And I really had to just pivot and just put in the hours, really, and, you know, so to get anywhere, really, it's just work. It's just hours. You just put in the decade, but having the focus as well about the main goals you need to get to the next level, whatever. And maybe some of you, you know, not ever, sometimes it's a flat hour. Maybe there is no level above. So.
Or sometimes maybe you're happy at that level as well, you know. Yeah. What would you, Adrian, add to that in terms of personal side of things?
I suppose I'm probably different than the two guys, that I didn't have, I didn't go on to university. I was literally spat out of school at 16. Had done work experience in a travel agency and thought, right, okay, that's what I'm going to do, and spent the next 13 years doing that. But and then I think what you can't teach someone is how to fail. And I have failed many times. I've been made redundant twice. My son's in the audience. I was made redundant when I was 7 months pregnant with him. That was really tough. And then being forced to change career, forced to go back into learning. I'm not saying I disagree with you, but I have a slightly different slant in that I'm 49. I really have no idea what I want to do with the rest of my life yet. I haven't found... I know I love what I do, but will I be doing this in 15 years, 20 years' time? I don't know.
Yeah.
Because I have moved careers and I've changed and I've done different things, because through different roles I've had to learn to fail, to put my big girl pants on and get up and try something new.
Yeah.
And with a new business, you know, we may be around in 5 years, please God we are, but you know, we may fail again, I don't know. But it's, for me, it's learning how to deal with the hard knocks.
Yeah. Okay. Then in terms of, like, I mean, the organisational impact of kind of the future of work, you know, are we going to see a situation where the robots who haven't shown up, the little fuckers, haven't shown up, they're supposed to come up the stairs and walk in and parade around, but they haven't shown up. So, but are we going to see a situation where, like, I mean, it's the robots who are going to control the C-suite? That's going to be, like, the chief executive of Citibank eventually is going to be a robot? Or is, like, that's just totally fanciful?
I think some of them already are.
I think if you get over the androgynous features that, you know, that the robot could be an AI that you communicate with, of all the things I've been most impressed with in the last number of years, has been the home. Anyone here got home assistants? Alexa, Google Home? Anyone got Google Home? Amazon then, so Alexa. I can't say enough how because you think, well, what's the difference? You got OK Google on your phone, you got OK Google on your right. It's just different when it's just, they really are really, really useful, and every one of you will have them in all your rooms. Being able to communicate with it and play and communicate, link it with the Chromecast, it's just really, but that's an AI there, and I'm surprised how much I communicate with it, how much I add appointments, okay, add that to my calendar, things I never do with my phone, but the speaker is there. I'm just saying that this intelligence coming in through smart speakers, and next year they're going to be £30, the year after that can be €10. Yeah. €5. You can just imagine the price drop, and they are so powerful. I mean, yes, they get some queries wrong, but again, there's things which really amaze me. I have it on volume 10, which is quite loud. You wouldn't hear you speaking right now, and I'll still say, "Okay, Google, pause," and it will hear you. How it does that with the music, you know, but. Those assistants, I've got friends who have them in the car with them even, and the Bluetooth speakers, but this kind of AI in the cloud again, going back to the giants will control it, but just communicating with them again. In the future, who's to say your boss giving you the orders, the person you're communicating with, well, the person I say, but is not an AI that's let loose by your company that you're communicating with. So I would never underestimate the rise of these home assistants, which become corporate assistants later, and it's just something, because again, we always move the goalposts. Whenever something, you know, years ago we said, well, when a computer beats a human at chess, that'll be true AI, which again, that happened, but it's not. When a human beats Go player or whatever else, but we always move the goalposts again, because we know true intelligence really is something different than a computer trying to simulate a human. But literally, just the assistance we're seeing at the moment, whether Siri and our Google Home assistants, are a glimpse of a future where...
Yeah. I come back to something you said at the very, very start, and you kind of pointed at the iPhone and said that's just 10 years old now. A couple of years ago, we did a banter in Derry with John Nocton. He's a lecturer at Open University. He writes at The Observer as well. And he kind of, like, was talking about the exact same thing about, like, I mean, the iPhone. He was kind of saying about when Gutenberg behind the printing press, you know, how long it took people to adjust to that. You know, it was just like it took people, like, decades to adjust to what has just happened. Whereas with the iPhone, in less than a decade, it's become totally commonplace. So when you talk there about, like, Alexa and all those kind of home assistants, you know, and I hear you as well, Adrian, I never imagine a situation where I'll say to kind of like Alexa, like, turn up the music. I can't imagine it happening. But then again, I never imagine a situation where I'll be walking around with my entire world in one of these, you know. Mm. Sometimes that organisational change happens at a rate that we find astonishing when we look back.
I think it's interesting as well, if you ask people what they want when they had horses, they would have said faster horses rather than a car. I think it's always a good analogy that we actually don't know what we want until we have the next or latest or best or the next iteration of what we experience.
Right. Okay, so, we're kind of coming to the end of it now. So any questions to the audience? Any observations to the audience?
The most worrying thing for me in all of this is that we're talking about all of this as if it's the future. And the reality is that this is not the future. A lot of this is the past, most of it is the present, and there's an awful lot still to come in the future. And with things like the big, big worry for me, which Adrian touched on, is the people who are unskilled. And it may be people who are not unskilled, but it's people who are doing unskilled jobs. So you leave university and you go and work in Tesco. Well, when Tesco is fully automated, when you leave university, what do you do until you get that job in whatever it is? So this is where things like the gig economy is going to be crucial, because you're going to leave university and you're going to be straight into the gig economy. And you're going to be an Uber driver, or you're going to be a delivery driver, or you're going to be a whatever it is. But that's not happening in 10 years, in 15 years. I have a whole set of friends who are in their early 30s, who work in retail, who are forklift drivers, who are taxi drivers. They're all going to be out of work in 5 years, realistically. Because, not that their jobs are all going to be totally automated, but how many of those people can we sustain? I was driving behind a bin lorry 6 months ago, and there was a guy getting out at every stop and putting a bin on and waiting for it to go up, and then he would put the bin back. Literally, about 3 months later, I was driving behind a bin lorry that had an arm coming out, lifting the bin and doing that on the same road. That guy's job doesn't exist anymore. Yeah. That's not 5,000 people wiped out of a job, but that's that guy out of a job.
Yeah.
And that's happening today, and it's going to happen tomorrow, and it's going to happen the next day. You know, you've all used the self-service in Tesco, and, you know, 10 years ago, that was just drip-feeding into things, but now almost every major shop has some form of self-service.
Yeah.
So retail jobs are fast disappearing, and what worries me is that there hasn't been any great think tank or government plan of what do we do with all of these people who don't have the desire to go and get an education, the means to get an education, or the interest in having a career.
Yeah.
There's a difference between having a career and a job, and so many people are just quite happy with a job.
Yeah.
But when the job's not there, are they going to go seeking a career? And what does society then look like when we have to look at that, you know, blanket paycheck for everybody?
Yeah.
Before anybody has to.
That's a really succinct kind of summing up of societal kind of effects of kind of, let's call it the present work, you know, the future work. And like, maybe there has been a government think tank about what to do, and maybe the result of that government think tank has been like, feck them.
That's the worrying thing.
I look at kind of like, you know, leaving aside your particular dysfunction in this country, you know, but like look at the dysfunction over in Britain right now, and like it wouldn't strike me as surprising at least if the Tories kind of went like, fuck, you know, they said it before to the miners, they said it before to those kind of, I mean, those kind of communities. So I like, but then again, that I'm being quite flippant like there as well. But like, you know, it's something that like all the we brought up again. What happens to that workless class? What happens to those classes that basically they've got no work to go to? Or if they have got work, it's a case of kind of like it's Uber today, Deliveroo tomorrow, and like, you know, something else the day after. That like, you know, suddenly you're in that situation where you don't have the 9-to-5 that every single person in this room knows about, you know? And like, I mean, again, it's that freelance economy thing. And I think, like, leaving aside the kind of like, you know, what you're talking about in terms of like coding, algorithms, the technology, it's a mindset thing. And I think that's something that like no one has properly addressed. I've yet to come across any sort of research on this at all that properly addresses how you deal with this, that comes up with solutions with this, because as you just kind of pointed out, it's something that like none of us can, it's almost like there's not enough computer space to kind of like facilitate that particular think process.
Can I say one thing? So my dad drives a forklift for work, and I am a coach, and the two things that I think coaching does is raise awareness and increase responsibility to do something about it. And I think my job when I go home at the weekends is to say to my dad, do you know that this is happening, right? Do you know that you have everything on your phone to learn? And I show him the apps that we have in work that we're really lucky to have to be able to learn anything that you want. And then you're willing to take responsibility. And I think we can raise awareness so much, and you can either proactively react or reactively react. And I think I'm trying to make him proactive about it, but he eventually will come to a point where he has to react to it. And that can be either passive and do nothing, or actually, Philip, I should have listened to you. Any chance you can have a chat to me about your phone?
And it also comes down to something that, like, you know, Kevin said in a different context, but it comes down to role models in a community as well. That, like, I mean, these all the people we're talking about, those bin lorry drivers and helpers, don't exist in isolation. They exist in the community. Are there other people in that community who are willing to be kind of role models? Again, I saw it in kind of Chantallo in Derry when we did Banter, and we worked with City Culture. We brought a thing called Other Voices up there, and there was a thing we did in outreach in Chantallo. Chantallo is a kind of fairly heavy duty working class area in Derry. It's pretty run down, doesn't have much opportunities. But again, you go in there, you find out who are the role models, who are the leaders of that community, and you kind of like get them to kind of like talk about, like, talk to kids about art, creativity, making music, doing workshops. And next thing, you get some vibrant going on. Yeah, like, Phil's right to talk about kind of responsibility. But I think, like, I mean, the responsibility is more than just about individuals. It's also about the communities. Next question. Yeah, one down.
I work as a journalist. Actually, for the Irish Times, that's what we'll go through this evening.
How are you doing?
Still. I was And it was a couple of weeks ago, it was a great story, everybody cheered whenever we saw it, that a website in America, a news website, a robot journalist had printed a story that was 100 years old, so everybody was sort of cheering. I just wondered what you think about the future of journalism in terms of, will we be replaced by machines at any point?
Well, I'm leaving the Irish Times in 10 days' time, so it's like, I mean, my future is definitely not the Irish Times.
To some degree, you have been at the moment. A lot of the fake news is generated by bots, you know,
yeah.
Unfortunately, and that's yeah.
Yeah, that's the thing. The future journalism is the bots, you know.
Yeah.
Future journalism is that kind of fake news stuff. Like, the future journalism is it's not about technology. In some ways, the focus is wrong. When we talk about, like, the future journalism, we talk about, like, that technology. Kevin just said the bots, the fake news thing. But actually, again, it comes down to a mindset change, you know. I mean, newspapers like the Irish Times have basically went down this kind of clickbaity rabbit hole, you know. Instead of concentrating on creating quality journalism, putting journalists like yourself and myself, sending us out into the kind of community to get stories, gather stories, like, find out what used to be the situation, like, why we got involved in journalism in the first place, which is go and meet people and talk to people. We're sitting in front of a laptop. Well, I don't know about you, but I see inside the offices people sitting at their computer all day, and they're generating 10 stories a day from kind of press releases that are coming in. Fucking Twitter stories. I mean, like, I'm serious, they're not stories. I mean, in many ways, like, journalism has eaten itself, you know. It's been, and it's like, this is the problem. When we look back in years to come, but what happened with journalism, it's a case of that we just got the jitters. We looked around at what was going on. We saw small, nimble, agile operations like Maximum Media, who do Joe.ie and Sport and Her.ie. There's probably equivalents up here as well. Those small, nimble, modern multimedia operations who can do video and news really, really fast, really, really cheaply. And we decided we're going to go after them instead of kind of concentrating on our strengths. You know, I look at journalism right now, and I just kind of go, it's horrific. It's absolutely horrific. There's so many people I know, good journalists, who are just like hitting their heads against the wall because there's no way out, because the people above them, the editors, the bosses, the financial controllers, the bean counters, have decided to kind of pursue this lowest common denominator clickbait world, and it's just really, really sad. Sorry.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting when the Grenfell Tower happened, that, like, an old print journalist from years ago from the local paper said if the investment had been in local papers, that it may not have happened. I know that sounds quite dramatic, but just
yeah.
In terms of, like,
coverage,
having a beat and being out
in the,
among the community.
Yeah, you've probably got equipment up here in Belfast and up here in Derry as well. But, like, the most important and most interesting development in Dublin journalism has been a newspaper called the Dublin Inquirer. It's a look. It's weekly, every week, every Wednesday on the web, and they do a print version once a month as well. And it covers local stories. It goes to council meetings, reports on council meetings. It reports on why certain sites are vacant. And what I find bizarre about this newspaper is that it came on the back of a banter we did on media in Dublin, and the two people who set it up, Sam and Lois. Sam is from Vermont in the States, and Lois is from kind of London via India. They're they're not Irish, they're not from Dublin at all, and they've created this vital media hub about what happens in the city, you know. And there's people are really interested in that, because we keep forgetting that sometimes the audience are interested in those kind of stories as well, you know.
I'm a personal assistant, so I'm interested to know where you see that role going in the future. I mean, obviously there's elements of technology that will help me do my job, but do you see it in the future becoming obsolete, that a robot could do my job, or what are your thoughts on that type of role?
You want to say that, Ken?
Not me. They would say that the class... you're in the emotional intelligence, so you're kind of in the safer categories at the moment as well, but... of course, there has been a lot of rollout of personal robotic assistants which go around with cameras on them, quite, you know, and try to. There's been a lovely, you know, you might have even seen in films a little seal that some people with dementia have, and they get attached to it. Pepe is a famous robot which is used in a good few care homes at the moment, and it's got a lot of investment behind it as well. It's got the camera on it. It speaks. It tries to interact with the patient in more natural language processing behind the intelligence. But again, most of these are just... We tend to read about them because they're kind of a quirky story and people publish them, but it's hard to see how effective they are, whether they're just a passing phase. But I think the caring professions still have...
Sorry, when I say personal assistant, I mean as in like an executive assistant.
That's right.
although there's an element of emotional intelligence. In fact, I think it's probably one of the most important words.
But oh, you're right, sorry.
It's very similar to looking after.
Sorry,
that's right.
Oh, no, you're
an, like an executive.
You're right, you're snookered.
I don't agree.
Sorry, Phil, go on.
So my girlfriend's a PA and she's sitting in the front row.
Right.
And I think, and it's interesting to go back to your question about journalism, it's what is your job?
Yeah.
Is your job to write stuff or is your job to educate or move people? And move, I mean, emotionally. And if you see your job in that way, that's different to what a machine can do. And it's the same for you as an assistant. What is your job? Is your job to diary manage? Is your job to make sure that that person's in the right place at the right time? Or is it to support them in doing their job to the best of their abilities?
It's a leadership role.
You are enabling a leader to do something exceptional that nobody else in that company can do. That's your value add. Diary management, outsource it. Take your Friday afternoon off. That's exciting. That's what I would focus on.
Yeah.
That's what I'm really interested in.
You see, I would kind of agree with not what Philip kind of said, that it's about making that role yourself. Go back to the question you said about like future journalism. The future journalism is doing stuff like this. It's doing it's taking the skills you have as a journalist and put like interviewing people, researching kind of stuff like this. It's finding other ways around it. And you're talking there about a PA. I was organising a meeting with someone in Intel, and there was back and forth, and a lot of it could have been done by a bot or a diary thing, but there was pieces of it that I know couldn't have been done because the Joe who was the PA to the boss, she knew things about where his movements were, and how certain meetings were kind of going to go, and how he didn't want, a bot would just say yes to everything. Or unless you probe them in such a way. So it's what you make it, you know what I mean? It's if you are indispensable to the person you're working with, there's no way a bot can replace that. I'm right?
That's right, yeah. If you go back to journalism as well, I work with a lot of, the term for them is key opinion leaders. These are guys with large Twitter followers and Facebook and LinkedIn as well. And the companies like the giants of the world will fly them around the world and bring them to events, of course, and just in the hope... In fact, in the expectation that they will write positive articles about generally these technology companies as well. But again, maybe you guys do it as well, but you can imagine that with journalism, and a lot of it in the future is all online again, is generating them, interest in followers and in all these, it's easier for you to write. And there's a huge market for that at the moment again. Companies know that their products are all being generally sold online.
It's about the skill set, basically. It's the skill set we have. Every single person in this room has a skill set. Don't think you don't have. You have a skill set. When you go in and write it down, you've got certain things. And for journalists, Jesus, when the end of the world happens, you will still need a journalist to write the headline, and you'll still need an editor to actually spell check it and make sure that your grammar is correct. We're indispensable. We're going to be around forever,
I'm going to be a real hog and ask another one, but one thing, and this is probably a question maybe, Kevin, that you could answer, but... one thing that I think is going to be a huge game changer in the future, and maybe I have to define what it is for some people, but is blockchain. So our entire society is built on the foundations of institutions. We depend on banks, we depend on credit reference agencies, we depend on criminal records bureaus to verify that everybody is telling the truth and everybody is being honest about everything all of the time and that everything is where it should be. And blockchain is going to change that because it's going to decentralize it. We're not going to need those institutions anymore. That's going to have a massive impact on jobs. It's going to have a massive impact on the economy. What do you think is going to be the time frame and the changes that we're going to see that blockchain is going to bring?
Yeah, I don't know the actual time frame, but you're dead right. I mean, one of the scariest things in security is the rise of the ransomware, which takes your files and that could not have been done even. That could not have been done in the past because the money was always traceable, even with the Western Union. It was large enough, even the government authorities in that country would have chased down the criminals. But cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin are based on blockchain. So blockchain is where a transaction goes into the chain and other nodes will verify it. And it's a wonderful technology. It's wonderfully done. And you're right, but unfortunately a lot of people come along and say blockchain for everything and they don't really understand it. But there is a lot of use cases where it is absolutely... Blockchain will be used. One of the scariest things in the future, which people haven't seen yet, but they will get around to it, is in the future when I walk into a shop and I take out my phone, or I don't even have it; it just knows that my phone's in vicinity, and I buy this glass, and I walk out with it, 6 months later, I throw it away or whatever. But every item is generally, I mean, a glass is probably the worst example, but every single item in the shop has a barcode. And it's traceable. So when the dumping comes along, if the wrapper is found anywhere or something is used or something, it'll always be chased back to me because the blockchain, which becomes this universal thing, which stores every single transaction because it costs nothing to store it, will always be able to trace it back to me, and I can never get rid of that. I mean, yes, I can pass it on. I can sell the glass, which has a barcode on it, to someone else, and then it becomes their possession. And of course, it's linked to them, and it's up to them. If they scatter it and break it or dump it in the street, or the police just come along and scan it and can see that the last owner of this glass was, you know, Mr. Jones, because it's in the blockchain. The blockchain will be used for so many things in the future because it just works. It's a way of having a decentralized authority, being able to transfer, to be able to trace everything that happens in a blockchain, in every transaction, literally.
The big thing right now the thing that made me think about this is that countries where there are thousands of people being displaced by terrorism, by natural disasters, things like this, there's a huge issue with these people not having any identity papers and nobody being able to prove who they are. And there's now technology that has been announced, and the companies involved escaped me, I must say, but they are now creating blockchain identities for these people, and these blockchain identities are decentralized and will go with them wherever they go, and doesn't rely on them carrying a passport and things like that. And to me, that changes everything. Where it's the old science fiction thing about having a chip in the back of your neck, you know, everybody knows everything about you, but blockchain is a further enabler. You know, you've got things like RFID technology already, and you've got barcodes that we've had for decades that were you know, are ubiquitous everywhere. But blockchain is a huge enabler to actually make that completely ubiquitous, and you know, it demolishes what we need banks for, it demolishes what we need passport offices for, it demolishes what we need credit reference agencies for. That takes out huge amounts of the big money in the world, and huge amounts of the focus of development and the economy, really. So that, to me, is going to be a massive change. And it's here today, again, it's not here tomorrow. Bitcoin is the first that we've seen that makes massive use of it, but it's here today. So I wonder what you guys all think of.
Can I say something about it? Because it's an area that I've actually printed out the paper, and it's in my laptop bag in the car, because I really want to learn about it, and I've watched a couple of TED Talks on it. And I think the decentralization, awesome, really good. The fact that terrorist groups, like you said, can't take away people's identities, that the system knows who you are because the system trusts itself, because everyone knows it, and you can't take that away. I think that's really interesting. But I guess the reason why I said yes to coming tonight is because I'm optimistic about the future. And what I think is interesting, and the reason why I wanted to make that example about the blockchain, is Citi have a think tank in Dublin, and they're looking at blockchain, and they're saying, this may disrupt us, how do we react to it?
Yeah.
We've raised our awareness, let's take responsibility. This could disrupt us, let's do something positive about it, rather than react down the line. And I think that kind of embodies what we need to be to the future, is react in a way that says, I have a choice here, do I reject and then be reacted on, or do I say, you know what, let's look at it in an interesting way. It may disrupt us and make us redundant, but that's interesting, let's explore and get curious about it.
It's really interesting. I've come across blockchain because I write about music business, and blockchain, this guy called Benji Rogers and Pledge Music has been doing a lot of running in terms of blockchain. And it's like, I've got to the stage where, geez, not enough already. Your three contributions, though, what you've just talked about there, makes me kind of realize I've got to go in and read up about this. Again, it's like, it's adopt and kind of find out more about it, because the uses you've just kind of outlined for it are revolutionary.
Yeah, it's a currency for the internet, because you can have also microtransactions. You could literally say you stream a movie right now, and you're streaming it, you probably have 300,000 bit, say, packets in within 30 seconds. But with Bitcoin, because you can reduce it to fractions, you can actually just pay for 1/300,000th of a bit. You can go through incredible fractions again, so it allows you to literally pay for, you know, packets on the internet, which would be impossible with the current denominations again. The problem with a lot of blockchain is this incentivization. The reason Bitcoin works is because you have miners who are trying to mine the Bitcoins, which are generated, you know, every 10 minutes, as we say. There's only going to be 21 million of them ever. But of course, they're mining at the moment at a loss, because electricity costs them probably at the moment 3 times more than the value of a Bitcoin, even though a Bitcoin is probably worth 1,000 quid now, well, around that. But they're doing it in the expectation of what we call the transaction fees in the future. But the problem is, it works because, of course, for the Bitcoin to be verified, that Bitcoin I gave you is not, and the whole reason Bitcoin and this cryptocurrency is so wonderful for the internet as well, it solves what we call this double spend. No other solution, a currency ever before a blockchain version could have. I could have tried to give you the money, but also spend it here.
Yeah.
And then only one if you would ever get the. But Bitcoin solves up the blockchain. But the reason it works because the blockchain is constantly verifying transactions because all the miners that are trying to get their next Bitcoin, and they're verifying the transaction. So whenever you get it, whenever someone comes along and says, "Look, I'm going to build a blockchain for X, Y, Z," you always have to ask, "Well, what's the incentive?" Because they're trying to build a blockchain for something which is not built on a cryptocurrency where there's going to be winners every 10 minutes, whatever. You got to always ask, well, what's incentivization for the other miners to keep involved in this blockchain, to keep it going? And inevitably, it always comes back to a centralized structure again. But still, it's a wonderful, again, it's the only technology we can think of right now that we don't know we really invented it. Which Satoshi Nakamoto is associated
exactly.
with it. But my gut feeling is it was a few guys. That's my gut feeling. It's too clever, too wonderful. The guy's a billionaire at the moment, but he hasn't touched it.
Cool. I think that's it. I think we've kind of cracked a nut. You all know what the future work is. You all know what you're going to be doing in 5 years' time. So please give a round of applause and thank you. Big thank you to our panelists, to Phil, KJ, and Kevin.
Thanks to Adrian, Kevin and Philip for joining us at Banter, and to Nisha, Kira, Michael and all at the Bullet Hotel in Belfast for their invitation and help. This Bantercast was produced by Tanya White. You can check out thisisbanter.com for news where we're up to at Banter, plus you can also listen back to all the Banter podcasts to date. We'll be back next week with another podcast. Until then, goodbye and take care.